Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Jim Hugler from Tyler. Jim is a criminal lawyer. He does trial and appellate work on the criminal side. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, we appreciate you being on with us. Before we started recording, we were chatting a little bit about how we've taken the show in a little bit of a criminal slant lately. But for those of us on the civil side, you know, it's so interesting to us because it's so different than what we do on a daily basis that I don't get tired of hearing about it. So, and you've got a broad range of experience, as I understand. Before we launch in any substantive discussion, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. I grew up in Chicago. My dad was transferred to Houston in high school, so I went to A&M. I met my wife there, went to South Texas after that, and my goal was to become a prosecutor. So the U.S. Attorney's Office in Houston for almost two full years, and then got a job up here in Tyler at the District Attorney's Office, and I did that for almost 8 years, and then set up my own practice. So I've been a solo since 2003. So Tyler has a very good bar. We've got almost 25% of our lawyers are board certified in one or more areas, and that is because we've got, you know, the state court, obviously, in Tyler and Smith County, the Court of Appeals, the 12th is here, and then we have federal courts as well, district and bankruptcy. So we're really a legal hub, and a lot of our lawyers are the top of their class. And that's what led me to go for, you know, board certification, both in criminal law and then in 2011 in criminal appellate law.
So when you started your career as prosecutor, were you doing just trial work or did you do some appeals too?
I did. Primarily, it was trial work. I did do three appeals on cases of mine that had been appealed. And our appellate lawyer, I went to him and said, hey, I'd like to do these briefs. What do I do? And he says, okay, here's what you do and go do them. So I got those three briefs under my belt as a prosecutor and then really started as a defense attorney. So much, much more experience there.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First of its kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
So you're board certified in criminal law, and then you said in 2011 you became board certified in criminal appellate law. I still think of that as a fairly new certification, but gosh, you've been certified for 10 years, so I guess it's not so new anymore.
It's not. We are still one of the smaller groups. I think we have about 100 criminal appellate specialists, and a decent number of them are on, you know, the Court of Criminal Appeals, various courts, defenders' offices.
What kind of background did you have to have just comparing the criminal to the civil? I assume it would have a certain number of appeals that you'd handled as first chair, written the briefs, done the arguments. Did that include any like post-conviction activities? Is that considered appellate work for purposes of the criminal appellate certification?
It would be. And we've got, I don't remember the exact TBLS standards. There was a certain number of appeals, a certain percentage of your practice, CLE, and you could do just direct appeals, petitions to the Court of Criminal Appeals, writs to the 1107 writs to the Court of Criminal Appeals, And then federal appellate work also counts towards those numbers.
How difficult is it to get oral arguments in the criminal context?
It can be very difficult. I've probably written more than 600 appellate briefs. Most of those, you know, I don't ask for oral argument because you don't need it based on the record. But I probably had, I know I've had fewer than 10 arguments. It's almost easier sometimes to get them at the Court of Criminal Appeals than it is the intermediate courts.
Is that true in federal court as well?
I believe so. Federal court, I had one. I was all excited. I was all set. I had my tickets to go down to New Orleans. And then they canceled it the week of, oral argument, and then affirmed the judgment. Didn't rule with me, but it took them 38 pages to affirm the judgment. So I felt a little good about that.
You made them work for it anyway.
I did.
That's a sort of a common issue between the civil and the criminal appellate certifications is the challenge has just gotten more and more difficult to achieve the requisite number of oral arguments. And I know that the TBLS, the Texas Board of Legal Specialization, has gone through and tweaked the qualifications requirements to sit for the exam at least once or twice to take that into account. But gosh, that's a remarkably low number of oral arguments for as many briefs as you have filed. I guess one way of explaining that might be that the courts view most criminal appeals as sort of routine and evidentiary as opposed to making any new points of law. Do you think that's correct?
That may be their thinking, you know, but the cases that we all know about, the cases we learned in constitutional law, were all criminal cases. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they're important and we've got some, you know, the way the courts, especially the Court of Criminal Appeals, were approaching some topics now, it's important material. And I wish some of the courts would be more allowing of oral argument. Some courts have a good reputation. The Dallas Court of Appeals generally grants oral argument if the parties request. The Houston courts have done that for me. And then the other courts, it almost as if, unless there is something they really need clarified, or if it's a big policy heavy case, they just don't give you the oral argument.
Mm-hmm. Do you do private client work, appointed work, a little bit of both?
Well, yeah.
I've heard, and through talking this over with previous guests of the show, that it's difficult to make doing criminal appellate work your living because by the time that the criminal defendant has gone through and been convicted, if there was money to start with, it's, you know, it's already been spent on the first level of the case. How has that been in your experience?
About the same. And we're in Tyler. We're a smaller jurisdiction. There are some very good criminal appellate lawyers in all the major metropolitan areas, and they can do appellate work all day, all night, and make a good living. In the smaller areas, that's a little more difficult to do for several reasons. That's why I've got both the trial side and the appellate side of my business, I suppose, or my practice. And I really think it complements. I mean, I know every time I do and I'm sure you guys have had the same experience, you prepare for a CLE topic, and that will affect how you practice in the future. So I know when I'm writing briefs, I'm looking for things in trial that I know might result in a good issue on appeal, and I do that more consciously. So I think that produces a better result both ways, you know, for my trial clients and for my appellate clients.
Yeah, Todd and I completely agree with you. I know we've talked about this a lot, but I think having an understanding of the trial process and being part of that makes you a better appellate lawyer, and being an appellate lawyer makes you better in the trial process because you kind of see down the road where some of the landmines can be, or you can kind of make a roadmap as you go along to make sure that you've got your case ready in the event that it's going to be appealed, or make sure that you've got all the stuff in there in case the other side appeals so that you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. Well, right now I'm a special assistant district attorney for a smaller county. They don't have any appellate lawyers in-house, and they've got a complicated capital murder case, and they wanted an appellate lawyer on just to help them with things like the jury charge and venue and some of those issues. And I think it was a very smart decision by that district attorney to bring on someone kind of like I've heard some of your other speakers talk about. Well, you're an appellate lawyer and you get consulted by the trial team to make sure so that you can see, give them kind of a roadmap of what issues are going to come up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it just sounds like on the criminal side, you just most of the time, unless you find that specific situation where you're getting appointed as a special assistant DA, it's not, you don't have the luxury when you're going and trying a criminal case of having a separate appellate lawyer sit there at counsel table with you to help do things like make the proper objections, preserve the error, argue the charge, and so forth. And so I'll just say that it's hard enough to get that kind of work as a civil appellate lawyer. I can only imagine on the criminal side, you know, that really it truly would be a luxury.
And occasionally it happens, but, you know, it not often. Much more frequently you get phone calls from colleagues. Mm-hmm. Hey, would you hear my facts? Am I on the right track? And that's right. Always good. It's great to have that kind of camaraderie.
Well, and it makes sense that it would be more often probably on the prosecution side just because they simply have the resources to make that happen where criminal defendants often don't.
Right.
One of the things that I thought was kind of interesting is you also work part-time as a municipal judge. Tell us a little bit about that. That's kind of a neat thing.
It is really fun. I've been an associate judge for the City of Tyler Municipal Court for the last almost 4 years. And we have really, Judge Amy McCullough, the presiding judge, and I have really worked over the last 4 years of making sure that our court is a real court with real due process for the people who come before it. And there was like many municipal courts, there has been a longstanding belief that officers have quotas and the city has a budget quota and it's cash register judges justice to supplement the city budget. And that isn't true, but we have worked very, very hard to get that message out that it is not true. And, you know, I know we have both had any number of people come up to us after the hearing or after a trial and say something like, well, you disagreed with me and you ruled against me, but you listened to me. And that is very gratifying to us. So we've really got some neat things going on at Tyler Municipal.
I imagine it's probably very fulfilling because so many members of the public, that's probably their only real interaction with the criminal justice system.
It really is. And we get at Tyler roughly 45 to 47,000 cases a year.
Wow.
And that is more than all the other trial courts in our county, federal, state, justice of the peace, everyone put together. So we see just a volume of people. And I think one of the things we really focus on, if we can convince the people who are coming to our court that court is a place where you get a fair shake, and if you have evidence, the judge will listen to your evidence, then we're doing a good thing for the whole community.
Imagine having a criminal defense background probably really helps with that too, because you kind of have a different mindset than someone who maybe has been a career prosecutor.
Yeah.
Well, and as a municipal judge, I mean, is a law license required to hold that position?
In our court, it is because we're a court of record, but there are a lot of courts, if they're not a court of record, yeah, you don't have to have a license. Now, don't have a license, you have additional training you have to go through with the Texas Municipal Court Education Center. But
I was just thinking that because you're a lawyer, that you're probably more conscious of things like, as you point out, due process and the way that things ought to be done in a courtroom. And as opposed to if it were a court that a law license were not required, I guess being a court of record is the determining factor on that, it sounds like.
Right.
So I could totally see how if it weren't a court of record, you could have brought very significant improvements just trying to keep things at a certain, you know, sort of what we would think of as a minimal level of service to the folks coming in. But I think that's great. You know, I'm surprised I come across lawyers who do part-time work as municipal judges, not infrequently, it seems like, and that everyone seems to find it really gratifying. You get to go out and meet the people, so to speak, in a way that you can't do sitting in your own office, right?
That's true. And then the pandemic and all those issues, we're having our second in-person jury trials next Monday, as a matter of fact, over at the Tyler Rose Garden. So It's been interesting.
How often do those cases get tried?
Pre-pandemic, we were trying cases. We had one trial day every week. Mm-hmm. So we'd alternate bench and jury trials. Over the pandemic, we're going back. We're changing that a little bit. It's going to be hopefully in August, we'll resume our operations for jury trials at our courthouse. And we're going to be doing those 3 weeks out of every four going forward for the next 3 months to try and get some of the cases that were set for jury trial, get those resolved.
Mm-hmm. We've heard a lot about court backlogs as a result of the pandemic. Would that be your experience? Were there a lot of, for example, were there people that were stuck in jail longer than they should have been because of the pandemic and couldn't get to trial?
Not with our court. One thing that we've done over the last 4 years, we still were meeting virtually on a daily basis with anybody who was in charge in the jail on our charges. And we'd either dispose of them or release them on personal bonds. So they weren't spending. And then our sheriff was not accepting Class C arrests for most offenses for a long time because of the pandemic. So we have not seen that the jail population grow as a result of our court, but I know it has slowed down the misdemeanor and the felony level courts, certainly in East Texas.
Well, I guess that's where I was really going. I wasn't thinking so much about your role as a municipal court judge. I was thinking about your role as a criminal defense lawyer.
Yeah.
That's where I really have heard where someone's in jail on a felony and they can't make bail. The pandemic was not a good time to be in that situation across the board.
No, we had one of our trial courts, I think this week, a district court tried a case and the gentleman had been in custody for 2 years, just sitting there, couldn't make bond.
Well, it has been nice to hear stories about how the courts have handled their workloads during the pandemic and how they've been able to, seems like more and more, I don't want to say resume normal activities because it's maybe not quite up to that level, but it sounds like Tyler and the folks there have done a good job of trying to avoid a lot of really difficult situations with, say, overcrowding the jail. And, you know, but early on, we didn't really know how this was transmitted. And so it could have been, you know, a real hotbed, so to speak. But it sounds like Tyler has done very well.
We certainly have tried. You know, it's been difficult, like everywhere else in the state. You know, there are judges, Emily Miskell over in Dallas, who's done virtual jury trials. And then the Judge Ferguson out in West Texas, mm-hmm. who's done none of our judges are ready to do that. So we haven't been as on top of it as some, but we're doing our best here.
I wanted to ask you specifically, just to change gears a bit. We mentioned post-conviction work early on when we started recording. And we've had some conversations here on the podcast about that. So hopefully folks who have listened to it have an idea of what we're talking about. But that's a significant part of your practice, as I understand it.
It is.
I was just going to ask you how you got into that. Is that a natural extension of doing criminal defense and appellate work?
It was after I left the DA's office, you know, I had done a few appeals. I wanted to get better at them. You have to have, at that time, it was, I believe, 5 appellate matters as lead counsel to sit for the criminal exam. Mm-hmm. And I had the 3 from the DA's office. I had picked up 2 more, but I hadn't had the opinions issue yet. So I was getting into that. And then Smith County back then and still now has on their indigent defense side, on the felony side, has a contract system. So there are 3 lawyers per court who handle all the indigent trial work. And then there were 2 lawyers who handled all the indigent post-conviction work. And I applied for that and I got that. That's how I really got into it and then really enjoyed it and just really developed a liking for trying to use the written word and a cold record to impart your client's humanity and try and convince an appellate court that something happened below and it needs to be fixed and here's why, or convince the Court of Criminal Appeals, here's a policy that we need to change and here's why. So the intellectual satisfaction has been very, very satisfying to me and completely different than the interaction you get with trial work, with working with a jury and talking with prosecutors. It's different in some ways and it's very similar in other ways.
Now, from the little bit of criminal exposure we've had on this podcast, it seems like writ work in particular is kind of a blend of appeal and trial because you've got the fact-finding role and the appellate role, which is an interesting hybrid.
It is. And writs can be tough because you have basically under Texas, you're going to get one writ and one post-conviction writ. And if you don't find something and don't raise it, you're going to more than likely be barred in the future from raising it, no matter how meritorious it was. So there's a lot of pressure on the writ attorneys, and on the writs that I do, I always have multiple meetings with my clients, and most of my clients are in custody for that. So, you know, the pandemic really slowed that down. We just have been able to get back in meeting with people in TDC units about 6 weeks ago or so. So I've been once a week going to a TDC unit because there's only so much you can convey in writing to someone who's in custody. It's a lot easier to have that hour, 2 hour long conversation, and you can get a lot more done than 15 letters back and forth.
Sure. Is that how it was handled during the pandemic? Was it all written communication, no video or anything?
Some of the units had some video, some of the units had phone capabilities, but primarily it was just all written. You know, it was really dependent on which unit it was.
I don't think we've really talked on the show with anyone yet about the federal post-conviction process. I know you mentioned you had done some federal work. What is the relationship? It seems like I recall from digging way back into the ancient past of law school that I know you can't take successive writs in state court, but how does it work when bringing a federal writ? I guess it has to be a federal constitutional issue, or maybe you can educate me on that because I don't think I'm explaining my question very well.
No, I think you are, and I'm probably the wrong guy to ask that. I've only done, I think, 3 federal post-conviction cases. 1 and 2 of those were appointed by federal judges. They related to juveniles after the Supreme Court said a juvenile couldn't get life without parole. So it was a fairly clearly defined issue and a newer opinion, you know, area of the law. So there are probably other people who would be much more qualified to speak on that.
It's always good to recognize our limitations. That is a wise man who does that.
Oh, what about on the trial side? Do you do much federal trial work? I mean, to the extent there is a lot of federal trial work to be had.
Yeah, that's one thing about the Eastern District that is really good. The prosecutors there are good professional prosecutors. And it's funny, the district between like the Plano Sherman area of the Eastern District and then the Tyler, Beaumont, Lufkin, Texarkana, most of the East Texas, we're a small legal community. We know each other. We serve on the same bar committees. We see each other at dinner. Our kids go to the same schools. And it's really very collegial. And generally, we can work things out. And if we can't, we're going to go to trial and we're going to fight hard in the courtroom and then go outside and shake hands and see each other again. And that is, at least my impression is, it's a little handled a little differently in a couple of the other divisions in the Eastern District where it's more contentious. So in Tyler, we've got maybe 2-3 criminal cases going to trial in federal court a year. It's really not many. And I think that's reflects on the U.S. Attorney's Office working with the defense bar and the defense bar, you know, being good lawyers and explaining to their clients, okay, yeah, this charge might not be the best one for you, but this one that's in the indictment really gets you. And, you know, if you go to trial, you can get tagged with both. Federal criminal law is NFL football, except the government, to some respect, is, you know, the Dallas Cowboys. And my team, we're the John Tyler Lions high school.
I was going to say, you better be careful with that Cowboys analogy. But I think you made it. Well, that's good to hear. It's always nice to hear stories of professionalism and lawyers working together to take care of the interest of justice. We don't always hear that. When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond, ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a $1 billion appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today. It does seem like your practice, you're uniquely situated because of your trial level practice and your appellate practice to do post-conviction work, because as Jody's pointed out, it does require elements of both trial lawyer skills and appellate lawyer skills. How does that work come to you besides, you mentioned, I think, some appointments early on? How do you generate that kind of work now?
A lot of it is, as I'm sure with civil appellate work, it's referrals from other attorneys. So they got someone who they call their regular family lawyer or the lawyer who may have handled a divorce or a property transaction. And they say, okay, I've got a relative and they have these problems. Who do I talk to? So after you get a good reputation, that's where I think most of my business comes from. And then surprisingly, when you're regularly responding and your client is in TDC and they get the letter from you and they see the quality of your work, that gets passed around. And then you get letters from family members. You know, my son Joe is in the gurney unit or in and saw a brief you did, and he has a similar issue in his case. So that is something that I hadn't expected, but has been fruitful. And you get there the opportunity to work on cases from across the state, not just write convictions right here.
So you do get to see a lot of the other courts of appeals with some frequency.
Yeah, I think I've appeared in front of 8 of the 14.
Wow.
I think that's right. And there's one criminal practitioner I know down in Austin who's hit all 14. That might be a bucket list. I haven't been to the Valley Courts, El Paso, Amarillo, or Lubbock. Those are the 4 off top, and Waco, so 5.
Well, even 8, that's pretty impressive.
It is.
All things considered, absolutely. Based on the sort of statewide spread of your practice, and I guess you were a pretty happy lawyer when e-filing came out and became widely available in the criminal, in the appellate courts to start with. But
yes,
it's become more prevalent among the trial courts as well. I can't recall. I know that the ultimate mandate is to make it available in all courts. Are you able to e-file in all your criminal cases now?
All the criminal cases, the only thing we can't yet is the juvenile matters. So I do a number of those, and that's just a statewide issue. Nobody does juvenile e-filing yet. I think the issue is just the different level of security with juvenile files and confidentiality, but I think that's coming. I'm sure Blake Hawthorne and the whole crew down in Austin are working on that.
Well, one of the things that we definitely wanted to talk to you about was your role as the course director for the handling your first or next criminal appeal CLE and the paper that came out of that. Can you kind of tell us a little bit of the background on that?
Sure. I was very fortunate to serve for 6 years on the State Bar CLE committee. Most of my time, it was chaired by Judge Xavier Rodriguez out of San Antonio. And it really gave me, we had people from all over the state working on that committee, every practice area. And really opened my eyes to that level of collegiality and professionalism. Scott Rothenberg is now the chair. He was on the committee with me for several years. And just, you know, great, great professionals. So as part of that committee, we're asked every time we meet to come up with topics for future CLEs. And the State Bar has really started, I guess, about 2 years ago, pushing kind of intro to areas, and it was handling your first or next divorce and handling your first or next probate, things like that. So I said at one, well, we need to do one for handling your first criminal appeal, because if you're a smaller town lawyer, you may get a call from a judge and you may get appointed to a criminal appeal. You've never done a criminal appeal before. So we want to give you a place to start so that you can do one well. And I think because I opened my mouth, they said, oh, well, Jim, you get to be the course director. We did that. Unfortunately, with the pandemic, we were supposed to be meeting in person at the State Bar. That didn't happen. But we had a great panel of just wonderful lawyers who worked with me on that. And everybody from, now I'm going to draw blanks. Judge David Newell from the Court of Criminal Appeals was there. Retired Judge Elsa Alcala was there. David Botts from San Antonio, who's an outstanding criminal appellate lawyer, was one of our speakers. So we had a great group of folks, and it was everything from starting and perfecting your appeal all the way to what happens at the end of it and how to do writs, things like that. So really was a good 7.5, 8-hour CLE.
Wow.
And I think it's still available on the state bar's website.
Texas Bar CLE, I would imagine, would have that. I'm really happy to hear that you did this. In my former practice, when I was on my own, I got a lot of calls from folks that I just couldn't help because I had no experience with criminal appeals. And even aside, I mean, if I wanted to help them and the, if the economics were going to work, I just wasn't comfortable even thinking about taking a criminal appeal. And, you know, one nice thing about those sort of introductory level courses is if you're going to explore a new practice area, if you get interested in something that you might want to expand into, they're, I think, a great resource for that. And I would have felt a lot more comfortable had I been able to take that course and hear the speakers and review the materials, in at least in maybe advising some people about options. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a real service to the bar in putting that course together. You know, criminal lawyers are going to have appeals go up, folks who do criminal trial practice, and there might be appellate lawyers who are interested in taking on criminal cases on the appellate side. And so that's a wonderful topic. And I'm so glad that y'all put that program together. It does sound like you had sort of an all-star lineup too.
Yeah. And then my part of the topic, you know, as course director, you sort of get to pick your own topic. And I was really inspired by Kent Rutter's paper on the reasons for reversal in, you know, the civil Texas appellate courts. And I did some quick research and nobody had ever done one of those for the criminal side. And in his last paper, the one from 2020, he really looked at the issues with the change in the courts, you know, in Houston, Dallas, and I believe San Antonio, about whether the election change and the shift from primarily a Republican court to a Democratic elected court produced any differences in the opinions. And I really wanted to do the same thing on the criminal side. So that's what led to my paper. And that was interesting. I didn't really realize how much I was signing up for when I bit that topic off. It took a while.
That is a very ambitious project, but it has to be extremely useful to people who practice in your area. So congratulations on biting off that one. And hopefully you were able to get past it. And now you can do what Kent does and just update it from time to time. Right. But you need an associate like he has to help you with it.
Yeah. And I had two very good people. I'm very fortunate. My legal assistant just got her master's in criminal justice. Mm-hmm. So she did all the statistical analysis to make sure what we were finding was statistically valid. And then I have a law student interning with me. So the three of us read 4,183 wow. criminal opinions.
Wow.
And we actually, the way we did it to satisfy statistical needs, we had one big giant spreadsheet, and we would go in and find out what the issue was, what the result was, what court it was. We collected a tremendous amount of data, and then it was back-checked by another of us three. So the first person would go through, second person would then read the same opinion and compare it, and we would bring up regularly. We'd have meetings every Friday afternoon at the office. Okay, well, here are the four cases where I disagreed with Stephen, or Stephen disagreed with Gabby, or Gabby disagreed with me, and we work those out because we wanted as clean a product for the statistical analysis as we could.
What were some of the takeaways? Were there things that surprised you?
There really were. There were surprises between the courts. Several of our courts, and you can probably imagine the ones, have almost all of their criminal docket coming from one county. So the 1st and the 14th, the 5th in Dallas, San Antonio, El Paso, Tyler, it comes from Smith County. But most of the other courts, all but one, you could link it to one or two counties. So Amarillo got almost all of that. Well, a largest percentage of their docket came from Potter or Randall. And that makes sense. The Texarkana court was the most diverse in counties feeding into it. They had, as I recall, 20 or 25 counties feeding into the Texarkana court. And so they didn't have any particular dominant county that they were seeing. It also surprised me how, even with rules that are identical, some courts do things differently. We found three courts that did not issue a per curiam opinion at all. Every opinion had a judge's signature on it. The San Antonio court at that time, even on the orders what I've seen is other courts having a routine order, you know, extending a briefing schedule or correcting a record. Most of the other courts I've seen have had those signed by the clerk, the deputy clerk for the court. The San Antonio court still uses still used at that time, a signature from the judge on the order going out. And I thought that was interesting. And I think just so you could see some differences in the courts. I guess on the thing that surprised me was how often ineffective assistance of counsel was raised on direct appeal. And in the criminal side, that is almost, well, it's going to be very, very rare that that will be a fruitful ground for appeal, because the appellate courts have said, hey, look, trial counsel has a right to defend what he or she did, and you can't make that analysis under Strickland based on this record without getting that lawyer's input. So that's why it was surprising to me that such a high percentage of cases included an ineffective claim. I was not surprised by sufficiency of the evidence, was not surprised by jury charge error, but I was surprised by the ineffective claims on direct appeal.
That's a wrinkle I'm not familiar with. When you say they have to get trial counsel's input, practically, how does that work?
Practically, what will happen most times is an attorney or the defendant will then file an 1107 writ alleging ineffective assistance of trial counsel. You know, my trial counsel didn't interview witness A and B, or didn't call witness C, or didn't challenge this piece of evidence. And when they file that in a writ, then the Court of Criminal Appeals has been very, very consistent about this. They'll send it to the trial court for a finding, either on affidavits or by live testimony, for that lawyer to explain why he didn't call A, B, or C, or why he didn't object to this evidence, that kind of thing.
Overall, I imagine the reversal rate on criminal opinions is pretty low.
It is. It is low. I think easily 3/4 of the cases are just straight affirms. Mm-hmm. Then you've got a number of cases that are dismissed based on motion, and then a number of cases that are dismissed following an Anders brief. And the difference there, an Anders brief, okay, for an appointed lawyer on a criminal case, if they can find no non-frivolous source of error, then as an officer of the court, they have the option of filing an Anders brief on following Anders versus California. You lay out the case and you say, okay, here's what happened and here's why there's nothing to raise. And I'll give you an example. You know, you may have a lawyer appointed to a case where the defendant has entered a plea of guilty, received some sort of probation, down the road violates the probation, enters pleas of true to the revocation, and then it's within the range of punishment. And there really isn't much there to raise. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Anders briefs, and there are criminal lawyers who disagree and have said, you know, I will never file an Anders brief. And they're lawyers I respect and trust. But anyway, if you're hired for an appeal and you don't find anything that you can in good faith raise, then you file a motion to dismiss and you've got to get your client's signature. So most cases are, yeah, just by far are affirmed or dismissed following one of those two. You do see a number of modifications of judgments for clerical errors, money issues. We have been seeing the money issues and the court costs raised over the last several years, and that's still a big topic, but far fewer reverse and remands, or a reverse and render is almost a unicorn. So it's just right. Rare.
Reverse and render in this context, you know, it's the criminal defendant who has appealed. And so a rendition would be a judgment of acquittal?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, it would seem like a unicorn just based on the sheer numbers. What has to happen? Give me one scenario or two if you can think of it easily. You know, what kind of error would there have to be to get a rendition, a judgment of acquittal on appeal?
In one, I appealed a case and it was a jury charge error coupled with improper prosecutor argument. And the Court of Appeals said, okay, this is just A, the jury charge was so bad, that's going to require a reversal. But B, the argument that was made by the state requires a rendition. Mm-hmm. The other one was a sufficiency, and I went to the Court of Criminal Appeals on that. That was two grandparents who had custody of their grandchildren. Grandchildren had burns on their feet, so the injury to a child cases were tried. They were convicted. There was a problem with one of the experts who was being used by the state. And what I wanted to do in that case was to bring back, because we used to have both a legal sufficiency evidence under in Texas, as well as a factual sufficiency. And I wanted them to consider bringing back factual sufficiency. And one of the questions I got in Austin was, okay, well, assume that we're not going to bring back factual sufficiency. You don't have any problem if we just render for your clients, do you? And I said, no.
Boy, talk about a softball question. Yeah.
It was a very good day for me. But it was based on sufficiency of the evidence. And that's why most of those are raised. You know, that's the single biggest category of appellate issue on the criminal side is just legal sufficiency.
Just such a difficult standard to overcome.
Yeah.
But with your permission, Jim, I'd like to put a link to your paper in our show notes, make it available for the folks listening to the podcast and later reading it on our webpage for the show, because I do think many of us on the civil side have read Kent Rutter's paper and rely on it in advising clients, not infrequently. And so I think your paper could accomplish the same thing to some degree on the criminal side. And we're certainly happy to help you, you know, get it out there in the world beyond the list of folks that attended your CLE program. Because that really was an ambitious project. And now you just need to find someone to help you keep it up, because that's 1 year snapshot of data is great. But what happens, you know, a year, 2 years from now is you have to analyze whether the trends are holding.
And that was really interesting, you know, and that I didn't know what to expect with the transition from over the court with the new judges being sworn in. And we really didn't see any statistical difference. So the whole thought of, well, you know, we've elected judges from one party. They are going to do a better or worse job of keeping the public safe. Judges of this party are going to let everyone out of jail. And that just, it was not borne up by the data at all, which I think, you know, might give some impetus to changing how we elect judges. But, you know, that's a whole different topic.
One we've covered before, but yeah, that's we dare not start a conversation on that this late in our visit today.
No.
I'm curious, what advice would you have for somebody who's maybe a lawyer starting out or maybe a criminal defense lawyer who wants to get into appeals? How would you suggest they go about that?
Find out who's doing the appeals in your area and have coffee with them. What you can do is start, okay, well, I've got an appeal. You can certainly help run facts by, you can get motions from the lawyer. You know, how do I answer questions as simple as, okay, I've got a client in TDC, how do I go visit them? Well, you know, here's the process that you have to go through and here's the paperwork you have to have. And getting involved with most areas of our state have local criminal defense associations. Certainly the Texas Criminal Defense Lawyers is an outstanding group of folks. And, you know, get involved there. So let lawyers know, hey, I'd like to help you on an appeal. You know, I'd like to help you do something so that I can do this on my own in the future. And lawyers will be receptive to that.
Well, and we're kind of getting toward the end of our time. And our tradition is always to ask for a tip or a war story. Do you have anything in mind you'd like to share with us?
I'm trying to think if you want funny or not.
It's up to you. Either way, I mean,
if you can work out funny in a criminal case, I want to hear it.
If you get oral argument at the Court of Criminal Appeals, you've got to stay at the DoubleTree Suites right there off the Capitol grounds, and you have to have dinner the night before at the Texas Chili Parlor. That seems to be good luck. In all seriousness, in criminal appeals, make sure with certain sections of your brief that you're playing it right over the plate. In the factual section, in the procedural history of the case, that's not the place to say, well, the judge wrongfully made this decision. You know, the judge made the decision. Leave the argument for the argument section. And for many years, for better or worse, it was a point of pride for me when the state would read my brief and they have the opportunity to offer their version of the facts. And they say, no, appellate counsel adequately addressed those. And that's their factual section. And then you read the opinion and the opinion is lifted from your statement of facts in your brief. So I think that honesty with the court is a very, very good thing. You know, you can do other things to advocate for your client, but at least in that section, it's got to be clean so that they know if they trust you on the facts, then they're going to be able to trust you on your interpretation of the law. They may disagree with it, but they know you're making that argument in good faith.
Mm-hmm. That applies like equally advice to the civil side.
Absolutely.
As does the tip about the double tree in the chili parlor. That's if you're at the Texas Supreme Court.
Yes.
Very conveniently located, both of them, to the high courts. Absolutely. Well, Jim, we sure enjoyed visiting with you and hearing about your practice. You know, as I said, every time we have someone on who does criminal work, we learn a lot. And it's really interesting to hear about how you run things in Tyler, you know, a little smaller city than where we are. But, you know, you've been very gracious and thank you so much for coming on with us and sharing your
knowledge. Really appreciate it.
Thanks again, Jim. We sure appreciate
you. Yes, absolutely.
We're glad to have you as a listener of the podcast, and hopefully our audience will learn as much as we did listening.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.